Shinny, Mexican food.
Oh. All right. Hello and welcome to Eat or No Lit. Mexican
food? What?
My name is Nick Argyris.
Do you always eat Mexican food as we record?
And this week...
Does he always whisper, I'm eating Mexican food as he begins the episode?
Nick Del Taco.
Trying to do this intro. Don't laugh at that. Don't laugh at that. Is this a show where we just laugh at everything?
There's a taco place by my house that was recently exposed as a cocaine front.
I read about that.
A lot of people went to jail.
Oh, it's right by your school, isn't it?
Yeah, it's across the street from the school that I work at, which makes it sound like I work at a really shady school. I really don't. My school's really nice. There's just a shady taco place across the street.
Hey, litheads, let me just tell you, a little peek behind the curtain here. I used to work in kitchens. I worked in professional kitchens for about 10 or 12 years of my life. And I will just go ahead and let you... Yeah, the best years. Thank you. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are drug fronts. The ones that are on the corner that you're like, how is that in business? It's drugs. It's drugs. It's like definitely drugs.
Right. And this isn't like a well-kept secret. This is kind of like the open secret of the restaurant industry. It's like, oh, yeah, that little bar that has that great burger that's really cheap that nobody goes to, they sell drugs. Like that is how they stay in business.
We know it.
It's so well known that they made a television show about it, Breaking Bad, where a character owns a chicken restaurant and it's a front for drugs.
Mm-hmm. Good connection.
Good connection.
Thank you.
We talk a lot about Breaking Bad on this show. We should watch a different show and then talk about that one too.
Better Call Saul.
Yeah, all right.
El Camino.
Oh, there it is. Now, Nick, when you say El Camino, do you mean the Netflix film or the album by the Black Keys?
It's just the car. Hello, the car. Welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week... Guys, I'm trying to do the intro here. Mm-hmm. And this week, I'm looking for a Pulitzer Prize winning book to read. And I can't quite figure this out on my own. So I've brought two English teachers here to help me with their recommendations. Ian and Joe.
In my headcanon, Nick does not know what Google is or how to use it.
No. And I have exactly one Audible credit per week. That is the premise of the show.
Well, my name's Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, I do have a book recommendation for you this week. A Pulitzer Prize winner by a guy named Colston Whitehead. This week, I'm, of course, talking about his 2016 Pulitzer Prize winner. Not to be confused with his 2020 Pulitzer Prize winner. I'm talking today about the Underground Railroad. The guy has two Pulitzer Prizes. How good is that?
It's pretty great.
A little greedy, but we'll accept it.
Howdy, Pulitzers. I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English Pulitzer. And today, Nick, if you're looking for a Pulitzer Prize winner, let me recommend Isabel Wilkerson. And especially let me recommend her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Now, Ian, this book, because it is the theme for this week, this book won a Pulitzer Prize. Is that correct?
So when I opened this book, I thought it had. When I read this book, I thought it had. When I went to double check my facts on the Pulitzer Prize website, I learned it had not.
Oh, no.
Now, you may ask, I am Arnold Schwarzeneggering my way into this. You may ask, fantastic, what happened? How did this take place? Well, the front cover of this book says...
Show it for everybody, Ian, so they can see it.
Right.
Yeah, look at this, people, right here.
Hold it up to the mic.
As you can see, dear litheads, the title is in the largest
letter. Clear as day.
The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. And then under that, in similarly large letters, it says Isabel Wilkerson. And under that, it says winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Now, I put it to you, litheads, that seeing this this front cover, you would imagine that the book itself has won the Pulitzer Prize. Not... that the author is a nationally renowned reporter who won the Pulitzer Prize 15 years before this book was published for feature reporting.
You know, Ian, I always think that one of the worst things I can say about a student in my class is that they are intentionally disruptive. I feel like that book cover is intentionally misleading. That feels misleading to me.
Yeah, it's like if they had a book that had a sticker that says now a major motion picture, but then there's small print that says not, like the now is actually the word not, but the T looks like a W. Mm-hmm. That's kind of thing.
It's a perfect example.
It seems So full disclosure, my book did not win a Pulitzer Prize. My author won a Pulitzer Prize for journalism 15, 16 years before the book came out. The book is brilliant. It won a variety of awards, but it did not win a Pulitzer Prize. So, gentlemen, I put it to you for arbitrage. Should this book be allowed to continue, or should I sit humming softly under my breath while Joe runs away with this one?
I really like the idea of us voting that it should not be allowed to continue, and then Ian having no recourse.
There's an unspoken contract. Like, okay, these all sound legit. Let's go for it. But I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's close enough, so we'll just move on.
Hey, you know what? Colson Whitehead, he has two Pulitzer Prizes, Ian. If you want one, you can have one. I am offering it to you this week his behalf. Yes.
Thank you.
We do have show rules, but ironically, that is not one of them, making sure that your book actually is qualified for the theme. So we kind of screwed up on that one. But on that note, welcome to You Don't Know Lit, where every week we pick a theme that is meaningless and then pick two books that kind of match that theme, as Ian is underscored. Yes.
Well, we picked two books that maybe are
you're making a mockery of our democracy here.
Fit the theme, but don't in fact fit the theme.
That too. If I was this author and I won a Pulitzer Prize winner, that shit is going on every book I write until I die.
Oh, not only that, I'm gonna like wear the sash around, and I assume they give you a tiara. I think you get a tiara for winning a Pulitzer.
I mean, I'm sure they don't. But
did you guys know
you would buy your own and then wear that everywhere?
It would say Pulitzer in Norway. On it.
In Norway, when you get a PhD, they give you
a
sword.
In Norway?
They give you a sword.
They give you a sword. They give you. Wow. It's not like one of these things where it's like, oh, you have the right to buy this kind of ceremonial sword. No. They're like, here is your degree. Here is your adulation. And here is the sword that you have won.
Here's a question for you. Mm-hmm. Now, you guys are learned.
Yes, that you is, are, you guys that are is the preferred you nomenclature. It.
You guys are learned English teachers. Pulitzer Prize, any weight there, or is that just another bullshit award?
So there are a lot of bullshit awards. You will, of course, remember that Trevor Noah won an Audi award for an iteration of his own book. But Pulitzer is about as hefty as they get.
Yeah, I would say, I would say that the Pulitzer is not quite as fancy as
Nobel.
The Nobel. Yeah.
The
Nobel
is bigger. I knew you were going to say Nobel.
But the Pulitzer is pretty fancy. I doing research for this, I was surprised. Maybe surprise is the wrong word. I was interested to learn that recently, in the last maybe 30, 40 years, there's been a lot of criticism that the Pulitzer highlights a certain ideology. That it says it's skewed toward, it's biased.
Have they been bought?
Well, yeah. So there's that. There is the problem that you can kind of write for the kind of Pulitzer style. But there's also there's also
like
the
Oscar movie.
Yeah, exactly. There's also the concern, which I'm not sure how legitimate it is, but it's out there that it's a liberal outlet, and if you write a conservative book, you don't get a Pulitzer.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know what to say.
Cry me a river. So anyway.
Sounds like a bunch of snowflakes to me.
We guys, please stop interrupting me. We have rules here. Rule number one.
No interruptions. Rule number one is no interruptions.
That's just is very ironic. Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers. Rule number two, omit needless words. Joseph Holshue. Rule number three, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. Rule number two does kind of apply to you too, Ian, though. So
absolutely.
But mostly Joe. Let's do our 30-second plot overviews here. Ian, would you like to go first with your 30 seconds?
Heck yeah, I would. Weaving history, psychological drama, sociology, and travel narrative. The Warmth of Other Suns, colon, the epic story of America's Great Migration, which is 622 pages, published in 2010, follows three black people who left the South during the Jim Crow era to look for a better life. Based on over a decade of research and interviews, this book is harrowing, mesmerizing, and eye-opening. It introduces a period of American history I knew nothing about.
Wow, that's great. Good. Tight 30.
And thank this you. Won a Pulitzer Prize, correct?
Sure didn't. The author did.
the author won a Pulitzer Prize for her journalism, his?
Yeah, for her journalism. So she was working for the New York Times and wrote a few really, really good pieces of journalism, feature pieces. And I've read them. They're excellent. Her writing is really, really good. For reasons I'll talk about later, but yes, she did not win. Folks, listen, litheads, if you're confused at all, you might be saying to yourself, an episode about Pulitzer Prize winners. Well, my Pulitzer Prize winner is Isabel Wilkerson, not her book.
Skirting the theme. Joe, do you want to take 30 seconds and just give me a brief overview about what your book is about so I can sit here on my throne and make a very judicial decision about who should go first.
Absolutely. The Underground Railroad, Nick, won a Pulitzer Prize. The book, it did. It is written by a guy named Arch Colson Chip Whitehead, or just Colson Whitehead, and it's a story about two slaves trying to escape the antebellum South. It follows Cora and Caesar, who make a bid for freedom from their Georgia plantations by following the Underground Railroad, which is, wait for it, an actual subterranean railroad connecting various safe houses all around the United States.
That's so wonderful.
It's just grips you right away, doesn't it? At each stop, they step not
no,
into
you're,
a
you're
piece.
Oh,
damn!
How long do you... No, let's get out of here.
Joe, I think
you knew it was done.
Was waiting for audience interaction.
I need somebody to forcibly stop me.
That's right.
Joe, is your book of, is this, are these fiction? Are these nonfiction?
So
it's completely true, Nick.
It's, Nick.
Go start digging.
Nick,
go dig.
You've heard of the Underground Railroad.
Yeah.
What if I told you it was a railroad under the ground?
Okay. Gotta go with that. Joseph.
Yes.
I'd like to hear more about this factually sound Underground Railroad.
Okay. So this book is a little bit wild, and it took me a while to figure out when
hang
I was
on,
reading
hang
it.
On hang on yes a book about a railroad that goes underground, you're saying it's a little bit wild?
It's a
I would
little
expect
bit
a lot wild.
It okay, it took me a while when I was reading this book. I went into it
when
pretty
was
cold.
The tunnel invented
when was the tunnel invented?
Yeah, just a quick question for you.
Like the idea of like digging through something that was solid. That
first tunnel first I mean, tunnel that a car could drive through. Early 1900s?
The first tunnel under a river was finished in 1843.
Wow. 43, wow. That's impressive.
Yeah, and that's pretty in line with this. Like, this is antebellum South, so antebellum is pre-Civil War, so 1843 sounds, that sounds all right.
And this has been Digging Tunnels.
Oh, yeah.
is this our book- newest segment on You Don't Know Lit.
Okay, I'm not really sure where to start this book. It took me a while to figure out what was going on when I was reading it, because as you good can sign. Guess, it's pretty weird. And it's pretty weird in a lot of good ways. When you read it, I guess just a little bit of background. There's two main characters. There's a teenage girl named Cora and a slightly older guy named Caesar. They work on a plantation in Georgia. They are both slaves, and they make a plan to escape. This is incredibly dangerous. Slaves who are caught escaping from this particular plantation are, I mean, they're murdered in brutal ways, right? But they do. Cora and Caesar escape. The night that they escape, they are almost caught. Yeah, well, like chapter one, guys. The night that they escape, they're almost caught, and Cora kills a teenage boy who is pursuing her with a rock. From there on out, they're fugitives, and they spend the novel pursued hotly by a super scary bad guy named Ridgeway. Cora and Caesar, they try to stay one step ahead of Ridgeway. They jump on the Underground Railroad. And this is like the wild part about this book, is if like a railroad underground isn't crazy enough. Each stop that they emerge at, and there's about like five or six stops that they emerge at here. Each stop that they emerge at, though, they find themselves in sort of alternate reality, a sort of like what could have been of slavery in America.
I have one question right now, which is more logistical than anything. I am guessing that since we have a railroad in the 1800s, it is probably steam driven, which requires the combustion of coal or wood.
Right.
And that's right. Involves the release of both steam and smoke.
Right.
Where does it go? And are people ever confused up in the upper lands to just see a hole maybe where there's smoke coming out of?
Right. Or like feel the ground beneath their feet lumbering. Or like does people dying of carbon monoxide poisoning?
Are you familiar with Old Faithful, Ian?
Oh, did they have a pipeline to Old Faithful just kind of spew it out there?
Well, you know, they have a system and it's a, you know, it's a well-oiled machine. And on the hour, every hour, that's when the train arrives, and that's when the steam comes up.
Honk, honk, as they say.
Yep.
As trains famously say, honk, honk.
So where does this journey through Wyoming take them?
So it takes them to a whole bunch of places. They end up in, they start in Georgia, they go to North Carolina, they spend some time in South Carolina, they spend some time in Tennessee, Indiana, and eventually kind of beyond.
Not very linear.
No. The problem with the Underground Railroad is you never know where it's going to take you. It has a very like, well, I mean, let's be real. It has a very magical quality to it. Like,
okay,
they go into somebody's basement. The train comes to pick them up. They don't know when it's coming, and it drops them off somewhere. And they don't know where that's going to be.
Wow. Oh, man, that was my question.
Sorry, Nick. You got to be faster with those metaphor questions.
Joe, is this a metaphor?
You should almost start every episode with, is this a metaphor? So this is a book, right? Is it
a metaphor? Get the overt metaphor out of the way, Joe, for us.
Okay, yeah, it's kind of a metaphor.
Or were you slowly building towards that?
No, I can get it out of the way now. Is it a metaphor? Sure, there's a reading that it's a metaphor. Like, you could certainly write an essay about how this tunnel represents, like, the black journey through America and how, you know, most people would ride overground and, like, they'd be able to see America by land and, like, have, like, the whole world and open to, like, this whole expanse open before them. You know, like, the black population is kept in the dark, only emerging here and there, and sometimes it's like super narrow and dusty, and yeah, there's a lot of stuff you could say about it.
Yeah,
but that's not the most interesting stuff about this book.
Okay, tell us more about the fantasy, because I'm picturing more of like a Harry Potter thing where they like run into a brick wall and then they're like on the other side of this fantasy world. Is it kind of like that?
It's,
do they have brooms that they ride on?
They do.
Get to the brooms, okay. Ian.
Great
Joe.
Question. Let me address these one by one. I'm going to start by saying they do not ride brooms, although I think it's probably just because Pulitzer Prize winner Colson Whitehead didn't think of it. And I'm going to say...
Colson, you're on real missed opportunity there.
Ooh, Colson. So no, they do not ride brooms, but it's not... We talked about in a previous episode, we talked about magical realism a little bit and how magical realism is this thing that like the author presents you a fantastical situation without much comment or delving into how it works or why it works. It's just there. And the author just presents it as fact and you kind of run with it. And that is what's going on here. Like there's this great scene and like the first time they're going to get on the train in which like they're asking some questions about it. Like they're asking questions like, well, where does it come from? And the guy who's like the conductor, I guess, is saying like, well, it comes from the previous stop. And they said, well, who built it? And he says, who builds anything? And that's kind of the explanation that you get. Like that is the extent of the explanation that you get, which is to say, not much of one. I have a little bit of stuff about Colston Whitehead himself.
I would like to hear about the author. I like his name a lot.
It's just, I mean, boy, we've had a lot of good names lately on this show. This has really got to be up there. I really like his full name, Arch Colston Chip Whitehead. But
Arch,
Colston Whitehead.
Is that short for Archibald, do you think?
Yeah, I kind of
say
do
yes.
Now. I kind
just
of
say
do
yes.
Now. Yeah, I'm going to say yeah.
Yeah.
So this guy is super accomplished, like super accomplished. He grew up in Manhattan. His parents were successful entrepreneurs. He graduated from Harvard. He had the MacArthur Genius Grant when he was in school. Since graduating, he has taught at Princeton, New York University, the University of Houston, Columbia, Brooklyn College, Hunter, like 10 different universities. He's been the writer in residence at a bunch of different ones. His parents are like pretty successful entrepreneurs. And at one point, he was like this good kid, this prep school kid, this kind of goody two shoes. And at one point he told them that he wanted to be a writer and his parents were kind of devastated.
As any parent would be,
but yeah,
that's up there with musician, I'd say.
Yeah. Things have gone pretty well for him. He started his career at the Village Voice. He's published something like 9 novels, most of them to like resounding universal acclaim. He writes a column on language for the New York Times, and I've said multiple times now that he's won 2 Pulitzers. He's one of only 4 authors to do that. There's only 3 others. One is Booth Tarkington. The other 2 are William Faulkner and John Updike. Mm. So yeah, like this guy's, he's legit.
To achieve the heights that Booth Tarkington did, my goodness.
So, Joe, as I look at the, let me get the exact number here real quick. The 5,614 one-star reviews on this book.
Yeah.
Trish, Matthew, Petra, Tom,
yes.
Anne, Chance. Are all of these people racists?
Oh, my God.
But more specifically, some of them are calling out the factual accuracy. Oh, I wish this was more factual.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is this a book in which you actually learn about the Underground Railroad, or is this more of just like an overt, like this is a new take on how to tell the story, or what's going on here?
Nick, that is such a great introduction to the game that I brought today.
Oh, yeah.
Nick, I brought a game today called Did It Happen? Did It Happen? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to describe to you.
Wait a minute.
Yep.
We're going to need to put facts in there somehow.
Oh, boy, I feel like that should be easy. Let me just think about it for a something.
Colston. Did it factin? Did it factin? Let's just go with that.
Oh, sure. Did it factin? Right. Did it factin? In this game, I'm going to explain something that happens in the book, right? All of these things are scenes from the book. And
okay.
I want you to tell me if these are factual scenes, like did they happen in American history?
Did they factin?
Did they factin? Or did they faked in, right? Are they not factual scenes?
Mm-hmm. Are you tracking these rules, Ian?
So hard.
Okay.
Yeah, it is tough. I think we're good. I think we'll make it.
Okay.
I think we got it.
At one point in this book, there is a scene in which black women are captured and sterilized, and black men are used as a test for subjects, as test subjects in an experiment to track the spread of syphilis. Nick and Ian, did it factin?
You know, you really started this fun game off with a real dark tone.
Oh, I think this is maybe the lightest of all of them.
Oh, Jesus no. Christ. Yes, these things both happened.
Yes, 100% factins.
Yeah, I started you off with an easy one because we talked about this last week, right?
Yeah,
we talked about the syphilis experiments, and a handful of states had eugenics programs. North Carolina was most prominent among them, but here's like where the Underground Railroad gets a little crazy. North Carolina had a eugenics program between 1933 and 1973. This book is, of course, set in the antebellum South, so pre-Civil War South. So one of the things that makes this book kind of wild is that, like, he reaches throughout history. Like mm-hmm. Colston White is a little fast and loose with the timeline, and he's looking for, like, these atrocities at any time.
He's building a larger story.
He's
not confined by a certain time period or fact.
Yeah. North Carolina in that time sterilized about 5,000 African-American women.
So this book, you can, if you look into it a little bit more, you can learn a lot more than the time period.
Oh, this book is
in which it's like theoretically supposed to take place.
So it's like secret learning.
It's, oh my God, it was so secret learning.
Can I say two things about eugenics before we move on?
Yeah, please.
First, those laws, the Nazis, who were famous for doing eugenics, modeled mm-hmm. their eugenics programs off of American programs. They were like, wow, the Americans are doing such a good job with eugenics, so we'll draw from them. The second point is that the 1973 end date seems kind of recent, but there's evidence that unofficial eugenics is still in place in Canada to this day.
Wow. With native populations.
Yep. First Nations people being forcibly sterilized.
There's rumors of that happening in our southern border as well. Like currently, like this year.
You know, eugenics seems to be like this idea that white people come up with every like 100 years or so. Like they're just like, oh, hey, what if we just, I just read a book not long ago.
It's not just white people and it's not every 100 years. Let's just keep it at that. We can move on to the next super fun question you have for us, Joe.
Oh man.
And if you love this game, we play fun games every week on You Don't Know What.
All right. I've got another did it fact. In this book, there is a state in which they arrive. I believe it is North Carolina. They get off the train and they find that in North Carolina, it is simply illegal to be black. Like you are not allowed to be black in North Carolina. And any black person found, free, slave, or otherwise, is violently executed. Did it factin?
Well, I need more clarity. Are you saying specifically in North Carolina, North Carolina, or just in general?
Yeah. In general. Good question.
Yes.
Good
factioned.
Question.
Yes. Yes.
I'm going to say yes. And I also think all of these are going to be factioned.
All right. So my answer on this one was sort of because of the North Carolina thing. There are towns in Oregon when the West was being settled in which they were settled by white supremacist separatists. And they were founded on this white supremacist ideal. So again, here it was illegal to be black. And once again, you have Colston Whitehead taking like these aspects of American history and then like kind of pushing them to the extreme, right? What if it wasn't this town in Oregon? What if it was the state of North Carolina?
This person's one-star review is like, I really wish he just stuck to the Underground Railroad. It's like, well, it sounds like it's pretty clear that he's not doing that. So, like, you just don't like the premise of the book? Like, then read a different book.
Yeah, it's...
It's like, go read a factual book then about the Underground Railroad if that's the only thing you want to learn about. I hate people. Keep going, Joe.
One of my favorite quotes... as I was kind of reading not the book itself, but the press and the reading that Ian and I do each week around these books, I found a quote from Whitehead that said his commitment when writing this book was to the truth of things, not the facts.
Yep.
I really loved that quote. Like he's like, look, I'm not capturing the facts. I'm capturing like the way it is.
Right. Toni Morrison says something similar in the introduction to Beloved. It's like, yeah, I could be devoted to the factual nature of it, but instead I'm going to kind of play with the facts in order to gesture towards or give the impression of a larger, more truthful thing. Because the idea is, I think sometimes facts can be misleading.
Right?
Yeah.
All right. I've got one more for us.
Have an emotional response. They don't necessarily warrant an emotional response or a large enough emotional response. Anyway, this is deeply upsetting. Joe, go on with your.
Yeah, I've got one more. And I think this one is, this is the image from this book that probably will stick with me the longest.
Well, it sounds like it's a fact. I'm sorry, just broke rule number three, which is no spoilers. Rule number one.
No, rule number three is winning isn't everything, and I'm winning this game, so.
It sounds like I think you both lost. Joe, Ian didn't bring a book that fit the theme. Joe's spoiling the book. All right, Joe, go.
So early in this book, there's this slave on this Georgia plantation. They have a particularly brutal owner. They have a particularly brutal master. And he is captured. He's a runaway slave. He's captured. He is castrated. He is flogged for the entertainment of dinner guests. Like, they throw a party in which, like, they have a special stocks built just for this runaway slave. They beat him. They castrate him. They douse him with oil and they roast him. Not only that, they take his penis that has been cut off.
Jesus.
They sew it inside of his mouth so that he cannot scream while they are roasting him. Is that a fact or is that a fake? Sorry, what is the name of this game? Did It Facten. Nick, Ian, Did It Facten.
Jesus, Joe.
I mean, okay. I think saying no, this did not facten, I mean, probably, if this specific thing didn't facten, something very, very similar to it factened at some point over the course of, you know.
Yeah.
Right. 400 years of slavery.
I mean, I'm glad you went first, Joe, because, like, I just hope Ian's is a little bit more positive. Or maybe just, like, he's going to choose to talk about things that are more positive instead of these vile, vile, vile things. But you are bringing the truth here. So I don't know. I guess it's a fact, and Joe.
Yeah. So the answer here, according to an interview from Whitehead, is it's not quite, it didn't quite fact. And basically every single thing is true, except they did not actually sew his penis in his mouth. That was Colson Whitehead taking a little bit of artistic license.
You know, at some point somebody did something like that. Like,
yeah, you know they did. Yeah.
Yeah. So these people are monsters.
Yeah. So this is it's obviously brutal. It's when you read this book, it's crazy because every page is filled with something that you just it just makes you wonder, wait a second, did that happen? Like holy smokes, I've never heard this before. We get like you know, we obviously all learn about slavery in America, you know, it's like well ingrained into the curriculum at every single level, but I feel like so often the takeaway is slavery is bad, right? Like that's the kind of like that's the thesis, obviously. Yes. I feel like when you get in, like one of the things this book does really well is you really get into the nitty gritty of not just slavery is bad, but oh, slavery is barbaric. And like slavery is dehumanizing, and slavery is maybe one of the greatest evils that man has ever like bestowed upon another man. Like this book is kind of wild.
It's top dog.
Yeah.
It's top dog when it comes to evil, isn't it?
It's
well, it seems too like, Joe, as you're talking about that, it's not just like slavery as an institution was bad, but the thing that the activity, the behaviors that the institution of slavery permitted or even encouraged or prompted in a variety of white people is the behavior that's the symptom of it is sort of its own kind of dreadful. We've talked in the last several weeks about the attempts to settle freed slaves back in Africa, and that's mm-hmm. obviously not as bad as torturing someone to death, but it's not great either. And like the sort of host of offspring of descendants, bad behaviors that descend from this overarching evil of slavery, there's like all kinds of dreadful things that are sourced back to the institution.
I just think it's important to know for today's climate. Like, it's like, well, you gotta know the history. Like, you can't make any judgments about what's happening now without looking at the history. So, Joe, did you like this book?
Okay. So I don't want to take
sick son of a bitch.
So I don't want to take a ton more time on this, but this book was conceptually one of the more interesting books I've read in a couple of years. When I talk about it like this, it sounds like it's entirely a downer. And there's certainly parts of this book that are downers. There's a lot in this book that is eye-opening, a lot in this book where I found myself asking, wait, did that happen? But it also is like kind of exciting and kind of thrilling. And there's like moments of triumph in this book. Like it's a cool kind of like plot driven book in a lot of ways.
Let me ask a better question.
Yep.
Without spoiling anything, is like, does this have any sort of like hopeful ending, or is there like some sort of takeaway message, or obviously there are parts of this book that are just incredibly jarring and depressing to dwell on, but like is there any hopeful part to this book at all?
The ending of this book is ambiguous, is what I would say. Like, yeah, I think you can,
that's a no.
Yeah, you can, no, I think you could certainly read it hopefully, and like things get better for our protagonist at the end of this book, like undeniably better than almost anything that they had encountered in the past. However, they don't get good, right? Like things get better, not good. So is it a hopeful ending? Well, I don't know. It's better.
You tell me.
You tell me.
I feel like, so hearing you talk about
this, DIY.
Hearing other, reading other books that are modern books about the history of slavery in the U.S., it feels like that a lot of times these modern novels invite a comparison to today. They say, they make us look and say, well, okay, have things changed? Are things better now than they used to be? And it's interesting that this doesn't seem to be saying like, well, it was all bad, but now it's good, or they got out and the North was better and that's all there is to it. Mm-mm. It seems like maybe it kind of dwells, it just lingers on the downer stuff, because it wasn't, nobody was really having a great time if you're Black in the 19th century.
Well, and Nick, you asked about the reviews earlier and like, are these people racist? And I think the answer is, well, no, but I think this book is so, well, in a lot of ways, it's downer, right? Spoiler alert, guys. We talk about downer books on this show.
We thrive at it.
Okay. Like in a lot of ways, it's a downer to read. But like, let's be real. You're reading a book called The Underground Railroad. It's kind of what you sign up for. I think the more jarring thing when you read this book is this blend of fact and fiction, this blend of like magical realism and this like Colston Whitehead, you know, searching for not the facts, but instead the truth. It's a cool book. I'm happy I read it. I won't be rushing to reread it, but yeah, I think Litheads, you'd probably like it. You should probably read it.
Hey, speaking of jarring violence, guess who started Blood Meridian?
Oh, God.
how are the nightmares?
Mm-hmm. If you just want to ask me, hey, Nick, how far along are you? Well, I just finished up the scene where one white gentleman was bashing two babies' brains in over some rocks. So you could say it's pretty shocking.
So you're
and
saying that
also
when,
dark.
So you're saying that when I brought the road and I talked about them roasting a baby on a spit in a road, that's not the most horrifying
Wizard
violence.
Of Oz, yep. Frolicking down the yellow brick road, not right. Towards the end of the book, but towards the beginning when everything was great, compared to this book.
Cormac McCarthy has a thing against babies.
Is Cormac McCarthy okay? Like, guys, I'm getting worried about Cormac.
Anyway,
Joe, I got one more question. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Please.
This is a fast yes or no question.
Yep.
Did this deserve the Pulitzer it won?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Oh my God, I am not qualified to answer that question.
That's a good answer. Good answer, Joe.
I have no idea if it deserved it. It's a pretty interesting book. The other books that I brought from 2016 were, you know, Trevor Noah, Born a Crime, and J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. I've been reading that. So I don't know. I probably enjoyed Born a Crime more.
May I answer?
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, it is.
There we go. So my book, which we're going to get to in just a second, takes place in part an area of New York City, which is hugely influential in the history of Black art in America. So it's Harlem.
Right.
which you may know from Shakes or Globetrotters, but I wanted to highlight the Harlem Renaissance, which was a period of Black literary and artistic growth. I'm not going to say much more about it because I don't want to spoil, but what if we brought Harlem Renaissance books?
Do I have to bring a book?
No, you. That's kind of you do. So, Nick, there's a fourth rule in this podcast, and that is when we talk about the Harlem Renaissance, Nick also has to bring a book. It's correct. A weird rule. It's esoteric. It doesn't come up very often. But next week, we do want to talk about the Harlem Renaissance.
The other part of that rule is that you're allowed to appoint a proxy. So if you want to appoint someone to be a proxy for you and bring a book in your stead, you can.
I'd like to appoint Joe.
Oh,
Joe will be going face to face against himself next week.
Yes.
I will be talking about, Ian, if you want to talk about the Harlem Renaissance, I'm going to talk about, it's the first name I think of when I think of the Harlem Renaissance, and that is, of course, Langston Hughes. And in, I think, a first, I guess we've talked about the Odyssey, we've talked about the Faerie Queen, but I want to bring some poems next week.
Sweet.
And I want to talk about the poetry of Langston Hughes.
I'm going to beat you up next week.
if by some quirk of the rule book, I am allowed to bring a book, I would like to bring the novel Passing by Nella Larsen. She is a fascinating author, and her book is short and interesting and dramatic. And it was one of two she ever wrote. And it's pretty good.
And I will be bringing a complete ignorance of the Harlem Renaissance.
Yes.
All right. Harlem Renaissance. Let's see you next week.
So much like Joe's book, this book has trains in it. Much like Joe's book.
Choo-choo!
Oh boy, Hong Kong.
Jesus.
As I think we've learned.
Brilliant, Joe.
Much like Joe's book, this book involves people going from a position of physical danger and what we might call economic hardship to a place that they hope is more safe. This book involves danger and journeys. But this book is different in that while it is fun to read and engaging, it is all true. There is none of that like, oh, is it fact or fiction? Like Isabel Wilkerson is doing historical reporting, historical storytelling, and it's all backed up either with personal narratives from her subjects or a bunch of research and archives and stuff. So that's a place where they diverge. They also diverge in that this book, I mean, it's not like perfectly happy, but all three of her central characters get out. It's not ambiguous. They get out of the bad situations they were in and they end up in better situations. And one of them even ends up happy. So,
and by get out, you mean get out from a terrible situation to just like an incredibly low baseline of like human decency.
Yeah, I mean,
is that what you mean?
Yes, and. So this book, the star of this book, I shouldn't have phrased it like that because there's three stars. The bulk of this book, most of this book follows specifically the lives of three people. And you don't need to remember their names.
no problem.
one is a sharecropper who travels from Mississippi. Oh, I should know that. I think it's Mississippi. She travels from the Central South to Chicago. One is a citrus picker who travels from Central Florida to New York City. And one is a doctor who travels from Louisiana to Southern California.
Don't say North Carolina, because I hear a lot of bad shit about that particular state, apparently.
No, the whole point is you leave your bad situation in the South and you go to the North. Now, none of these people are slaves. These people all live in the 20th century. So the sharecropper is the oldest, but the other two, they're all kind of working in the restrictive confines of the South, though.
What is the time? What is the 20th century? Like, which part? Because that is a good question.
They're really big old. Century. Like, these people get really old. So, one of them dies in 2005. And the story follows her all the way up there. Mostly it's from like about 1910 ish through 1990 or so. That's kind of the big scope.
Wow. Almost the whole century. Okay.
So, yeah. Yeah. It's huge.
Okay, so again, I'm sorry as ask these questions.
That's your job. Go
so
ahead.
So this is my job.
Question. Yeah.
It's my job to ask the question.
Yep.
You're doing a good job.
And it's my job here to sidestep them. And, not really
and talk about what I want
to
talk
and
about.
And to play a game. What's your question, Nick?
Man, Joe, that's the worst game ever.
You know, when I was looking for a game this week, I was, you know, we always kick around a few different ideas for
how
games.
How could I cripple these people emotionally?
And I'm just like, well, a lot of horrifying things happen in this book that I ended up looking up online later. Let's make that a game.
Yeah, good job. So, Ian, this is fact and fiction, correct?
No.
Yeah, okay.
It's all fact.
100% fact.
100% fact.
Okay, gotcha.
Yep. Yeah, so she...
And what's the premise of this book? I know you've touched on that a bit.
Right.
Square one, what's the premise of this book?
So she's telling the story of a period of social and geographical change, demographic change in the U.S. called by historians the Great Migration, which is basically a bunch of black people were living in the South, and then Jim Crow was really oppressive, and they were like, we hate this, so they moved elsewhere. And this thing is a trend that a bunch of historians and sociologists have written about. But she said, I'm going to give this a human face. So these personal narratives, she has three people who were
who did this.
Yeah. Tracked them down in the 1990s and she talked to them over the course of about 15 years. She
That's
started the
cool.
research in the mid 90s.
Awesome.
And she published this in 2010.
You know, this is cool. I work with a lot of students who like to write college essays and scholarships. It's like part of my job at the high school. And one of the things I always encourage them, because students always want to write down their facts. Like they always want to write down, this is my GPA. This is how many AP right. credits I've taken. This is my volunteer hours. And I always tell them, I'm like, look, people don't give scholarships to a list of facts. Like people don't care about facts. People give scholarships to people. Right?
Yeah.
Like put a face on this.
Yeah.
And this sounds like I'm going to care about the Great Migration, Ian.
Yeah. You got to humanize it. And
yeah,
so these characters, this is the thing. It's weird because this book was as like engaging as a really well-written biography or even a fiction book. She is such a good writer. Pulitzer Prize winning, in fact, for a different project. She's such a good writer that like, she finds ways to bring in details and make this feel like we're there.
Hey, Ian, I gotta ask the question. Why didn't you bring the Pulitzer Prize article that she wrote?
Because that was like a series of articles about Canada, wasn't it?
Seems like you could have just brought that.
I could have. If I win, I've got an excerpt from her Pulitzer Prize winning reporting to read.
Okay. You're probably gonna win because I really like how this sounds.
Yeah, I was just looking for quotes.
Oh, hey, then you should be thanking me that I just saved you a lot of time. Do you think this reads similar to what might be the leading book of this entire podcast, which is the Tom Wolfe's reporting The Right Stuff, which is just we can't say enough good things about The Right Stuff here, folks.
Just a fantastic book.
It's a fantastic book. Do you think this kind of reads like that? Is this kind of like reporting? What was that a genre?
Yeah.
Joe?
Well, I think Joe referred to it as like new journalism, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Spelled wrong.
with a G.
Yeah,
with
I definitely
G
think so.
For new end journalism.
NUGHEU.
I think it was spelled
definitely
wrong.
German reporting.
This book has kind of the fingerprints of a more artistic approach to journalism. Like what
yes,
she's doing
yes.
mm-hmm. could be read as like a book length journalistic project with these main central personal narratives. She talks to them. She drives around with them. She hears their stories. She listens to them repeat the same stories over and over because they're kind of old when she meets them. She attends funerals with them. This sounds weird. I don't mean this in like an exploitative way, but she kind of embeds herself in their life a little bit so that she gets to see in person The stuff that the sharecropper, Ida May. Ida May Gladney is the sharecropper who goes to Chicago, and she's just this amazing, really, she's really old and just a wonderful, funny, caring lady who lives on a corner where there are drug busts all the time. And this little lady sits in front of her window and watches out the front window instead of watching TV. And
oh,
she
great.
Loves this. She's like, I don't need adorable. A TV because I can see like, oh, there's a cop. I recognize that guy. Oh, that's a bad part of the gang. Those are some nice gangbangers over there. Oh, there's going to be a crisis. Yep, there it is. There are the shots. And it's just like she.
Who needs TV?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know if that's adorable, but.
But it has a charm. Like there's a charming element to that.
It's charming how Ian just said it, but I'm not sure if it's actually charming.
Well, this is the thing. She talks about pretty dreadful stuff. Like this is not. Like one of our main characters, Robert Foster, he leaves.
Can you introduce the three characters?
Yeah. So we have Ida May Gadney as the sharecropper. Robert Foster is the doctor.
The doctor. Yeah. He leaves small town Louisiana and becomes a doctor to the stars in Southern California, including becoming Ray Charles's doctor. There's a point at the end of the book where Ray Charles is like, hey man, you're the best and you're getting old and I know you can't eat a lot of stuff, but also I have a bunch of steaks for you. Can I bring them over? And Robert Foster's like, yes, you can. And so Ray Charles comes over and brings like 12 pounds of steak.
Oh, that's a nice.
So
story.
There's that one. And then the third one.
I was going to ask if you had any steak-based stories.
Checking that box. The third one is George Sterling. And George Sterling is an organizer in the citrus groves in Florida. And he goes to New York City. And his story. So Ida May Gladney's story is pretty happy. Like she kind of becomes this legend in her Southside neighborhood. And her family is all around her. And she's kind of happy. George Sterling's story is good in that he gets away from kind of the cruelty and danger of Florida. But also his family isn't so happy and he has some children who get involved in drugs and he doesn't really realize his potential. And Robert Foster, the doctor, is kind of like the saddest because he chases like happiness so hard and he's so
like
determined.
The American dream.
He pushes so hard. And at the end, he kind of dies alone and he's kind of like, it's not like, wow, these people went to the North or they left the South and their lives were better forever. It's like, these are people living in the world. And so even though they were not in danger of being lynched, they were not in danger of being like beaten to death or, thrown in jail for looking at a white person the wrong way. They had to deal with stuff. Their lives were not, not easy. It's very realistic. Yeah.
All I was going to say about Robert Foster being sad is like Ray Charles brought you 12 pounds of steak. So like that's pretty good.
Yeah. And my point was going to be that we all die alone. So at least he got to follow his dream, right? I mean, at least he was kind of,
absolutely.
I don't know, at least his career found success.
Oh, but yeah. And he's like, he's,
but he didn't find personal success or happiness or something is what you're saying.
He's a legend
or
he becomes like, there's a whole passage where it's talking about his lifestyle where he goes to Vegas every weekend. He lives in Los Angeles and he just drives to Vegas and he's a high roller there and he wears crushed velvet suits and everyone knows him and everyone loves him. And he makes like hundreds of thousands of dollars playing high stakes poker. And he likes this life.
Well, yeah, it sounds awesome.
I'm very, I wanted to hear your thoughts and then, see where that went, but I am going to go with Joe here and say that things turned out pretty well for him.
Things sound okay
for Robert
Foster.
Can you be more specific why things didn't go? What are we missing here?
Well, so I think it's really kind of a, she treats these people as people.
Did he have to leave things behind?
So here's how I'll say it. She, Wilkerson, gets to know these people as human beings, and she always depicts them as real human beings, contradictory with making mistakes and all this stuff. But she also writes them kind of as characters. And so if you were going to talk about Robert Foster as a character, he's a guy who quests for happiness, but never, it never gives, the things he does never give him the happiness that he expects them to. So like, yeah.
What does he expect? I'm genuinely curious.
He expects he expects money and success and fame to solve all of his problems. And so he won't be alone.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, that is kind of the promise of the American dream, right? Like if Robert Foster is disappointed in that, I think he can get in line. Like, I think a lot of people have been promised
Join
that.
Join the club, Robert.
Take a number, Foster.
Yeah. I mean, ask me how many pounds of steak I've received from a famous piano player.
Right. I don't even think Stevie Wonder's ever brought me steak.
Wait, hold on the hierarchy of
I don't know. I
wasn't piano question, players no. here.
I was just trying to make another blind person.
Is Ray Charles higher or lower than Stevie Wonder?
I think Ray Charles is higher.
I think Stevie Wonder. Ooh.
You just say that because Stevie Wonder was on Full House.
First off, nobody said that ever. Secondly, Stevie Wonder is like an angel's voice.
Yeah.
It's so clean. It's
Isn't crazy. She lovely?
Oh.
Isn't she wonderful?
Ian, tell us why this book is lovely.
Okay, so I've talked a lot about the personal narratives, and that's kind of the star, I would say. But she makes this make sense, and this is kind of the other aspect of this book. She makes these makes these personal stories kind of matter by putting them in the context of the Great Migration. So had you guys heard of this before? I just mentioned it a few.
Only just very vaguely. Like it's this idea of blacks moving out of the South.
Right. So this term, you probably are familiar with the term white flight, which is often used to describe how between the 1950s and the 1970s, city dwellers who were white left urban centers to go live in suburbs. The Great Migration is like that, but bigger and longer. So black people were in the South and they didn't like it because lynchings were common and schools and transportation and everything was segregated. Earning opportunities were artificially depressed. They hated it.
The list goes on and on.
Yes. And on. Yeah. I'm not going to go on and on, but they were leaving and they were going to other places. So if you were on, one of the fascinating things about how this goes is she says, based on where you were in the South, you would go to different areas of the country. So if you were living on the Atlantic seaboard, you would ride the rails north to Pennsylvania or New York or New England. If you were living just kind of in the middle South, what's that?
Right.
No, sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say just because of like the means of transportation that existed.
Exactly.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Because like it was easy to get on a train going west, or it was easy to get on a train to go into the Northeast
Get on the number 5 and get the fuck out of there as soon as you can.
Right.
Is this why everybody, all the old people in Wisconsin go to Arizona? Like, is that the same sort of thing? Like you could go anywhere, but we go to Arizona.
I don't think it works. I don't think it works that way any longer, but she does say, So her character, Ida Mae Gladney, her focus, that person, she is from the Middle South. So she goes up kind of straight up the gut, up north, first to Illinois and then to Milwaukee. And there's this fascinating part where our author
goes somewhere else.
This is where she Chicago. Has family. And this is where
that's why we all stay.
Right. She believes that like she and her husband, she goes with her husband and her family. They believe that this is where they can get a job. And they don't have the luxury of buying a car. So they take the train. But she says one of the fascinating things that she does, Wilkerson does with this story is you can track where black people's roots are, or you could for a long time, maybe not so much anymore with more mobility and stuff, but for a long time, if you were black in the upper Midwest, you probably had family ties in the Middle South. If you were black in the Northeast, you had family ties on the Atlantic seaboard, Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas. If you're black on the West Coast, you probably had family ties to Louisiana, to Arkansas, to Texas, to these kinds of places. And the idea, she says, you could with the older folks, you could hear the difference in their dialects.
That's really cool.
I'm ready to hear a little bit more about this book, Ian. We cut you off when you were talking about the Great Migration.
Yes. So to help with this, to help put this kind of in perspective, I have some numbers for you guys. And we could do this like a game, or I could just kind of tell you what they are, because the game thing is kind of overdone at this point. Here's one. Here's a number. 14. There are 14 states which are considered to be southern states or part of the larger subregion of the South. And a lot of these are pretty like obvious, like Florida or Mississippi. They also count Texas, and they also count Delaware. So there were a lot. There were a lot of states that were kind of classed in the South. Another number, one of my least favorite numbers from this list is...
Yeah, they're not all great numbers.
No. This is a bad number. This is 3,959, which is the most recent estimate of the number of black people lynched in the South between 1877 and 1950. So this is just people who died that we can document. One of the risks of this whole sort of story is it runs the risk of kind of being... focusing on the big ones, you know, your Emmett Tills, or those kinds of very well-known examples. But there were thousands of people, and there were thousands, millions who lived in fear. So this is my next number. Mm-hmm. 6 million.
Migrants.
Yeah, this is the low estimate. So it's probably anywhere up to 10 million. The low estimate of black people who left the South during the Great Migration. So 6 million people over the course of those decades. Two more numbers. 91 is the percent of black people living in the South in 1870. The percent of America's black people living in the South in 1870. So in 1870, just after the Civil War, there were 91% of all of the black people in the U.S. lived in those 14 states. Wow. 100 years later, that had gone down to 53%.
Wow.
Holy
smokes.
Are these all numbers you get from the book, or is this just your own?
Some of them. So she's pretty good. She researched the kind of the large scale stuff pretty carefully, but she doesn't overwhelm you with it. It does a pretty good job of making this huge movement over the course of like 80 years accessible in the course of.
Yeah, that's well put, I would say.
Yeah.
Maybe one last question. Was this book worthy of a Pulitzer Prize? Do you think it should have won?
I will say that her writing is perhaps some of the most powerful nonfiction prose I have ever read. It is so good.
Ian, before you read your quote, because Joe lost, can you quick hawk this podcast for us?
Of course. Litheads, listen. I think if any podcast should win a Pulitzer, it probably shouldn't be this one. We're not really established yet. But I tell you what, and maybe someday, I don't know, if they have a Pulitzer for podcasting, we can get there. Head on over to our social media channels. Those are at You Don't Know Lit. We also have a website, You Don't Know Lit podcast, and submit a book. Tell us what to do. We will heed
please.
Your wise
counsel. We will do it. We'll do it. We'll do it. Litheads.
Ian, don't make us sound so desperate.
tell us what to do.
Please. No, seriously. I don't know. I envision this as a symbiotic relationship with the Litheads. They tell me what to read, and I read it, and I'm like, thank you. That's a good book.
Thank you. May I have another?
Yes.
Litheads, we love you.
Ian, make this one hurt for Joe.
All right. I was going to read a segment of an article that Wilkerson won a Pulitzer for, but we've talked so much about steaks, I kind of feel like I should read the steak section. So I'm going to read the steak section.
Fuck yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah.
This is toward the end of the book. Robert Foster has much reduced sort of social life. He used to be throwing grand parties, and he's kind of restricted to his home now. And here's how it goes. Robert has just gotten out of the hospital again, and the phone is ringing like mad. One time, Barbara picked up the phone and heard a gravel voice that sounded familiar. "This is Ray Charles," the man said. "Let's speak to the old man. I'm calling to see if he wants some steaks." Barbara was holding the receiver to her ear and the cradle to her hip. She whispered to Robert, "Ray Charles is on the phone." Robert took the receiver, and Ray got straight to the point.
Cool.
"You gonna be at home?" Ray asked him. "You want these steaks? I'll be over there with them." Barbara was in a panic. Ray Charles was on his way. She had just cleaned the living room, but she hadn't got to the kitchen or vacuumed the orange carpet in the den where Robert spent most of his day. When it occurred to her, what was the point of rushing? "He can't see anyway," she said to herself. "He won't know what room he's in." She calmed herself down. When the doorbell rang and Ray Charles arrived, she sent him through the kitchen. "You just say step up or step down," she later recounted. "Why should I let him trample through the living room? I just finished vacuuming. He wasn't dressed up. He don't know the difference." Ray Charles came bearing 10 or 12 steaks that Robert was not supposed to have, but that no one in the world could stop Ray Charles from giving him. All New York cut or porterhouse, no T-bone. Just as Robert liked it. Ray chided Robert for not letting him know what hospital he had been in. "Now I had to call all over town, every hospital looking for you," Ray said. "Where in the hell did you go? Why did you go way out there? I'm gonna shoot you if you go off again and don't let me know where you are."